It had been a terrifyingly impressive sight back then, for all that it meant rescue from certain death. Once Stephanopoulos had finished with her tour, I found Nightingale giving the damage a cool appraisal. He shook his head and looked disapproving. See that? He pointed at a section of first floor window frame, hanging suspended from what looked like a curtain rail. Very shoddy. I'd say our man was not himself when he cast his opening spell. He'd been enough of himself to rip out the base of Tyburn's expensive period staircase, leaving the polished balusters hanging like broken teeth from the handrail. The back wall of the parlour had been smashed into the room behind, the wall-mounted TV ripped neatly in half, with one part embedded in the ceiling and the other lodged at head height in a kitchen cabinet. Olivia and Phoebe had been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine on that TV when the attack had started, and had only avoided serious injury because they'd both happened to be lying prone on the sofa. "Saved by snogging," had been Sewall's verdict. "Won't that be a lesson to you?" Nightingale's lesson was slightly different. "He just went straight in with no thought as to where his target might be," he said. "And if you look at the line of his effort there..." Nightingale swept his hand to indicate where a wide crack had shattered the delicate Regency moulding in the corner of the room. "You'll see that it lacks precision. A surefire sign of..." "What exactly, Mr. Grant?" "One of the underlying former was not properly developed," I said. Nightingale's lips twitched. "Can you tell which one?" he asked. I studied the crack. I had no idea what the spell would have been, but probably fourth or fifth order, given it was doing quite a number of different things at the same time. Since it was shoving masonry around, the spell had to be impello-based, but not even I mess impello up, so it probably had to be one of the modifiers. "Temporare," I said, totally guessing.
"Yes," said Nightingale. "I think you're right."
He looked at Martin Chorley's handiwork and shook his head again.
"Definitely off his game," he said.
Not so much off his game that he hadn't managed to do that much damage in less than 5 seconds, between his casting a spell and a fountain of water bursting up his trouser leg. I'd have loved to have had CCTV of that. But of course every camera within 100 meters had gone fucked when he cast the spell.
"Entirely on purpose, in Nightingale's professional opinion."
"And yet no vestigia," I said, "at least nothing I could sense. On a Regency Street in central London, there should have at least been the background afterglow of everyday magic. But standing in front of the ruined house, I could feel nothing. Less than nothing. A vast, sucking silence. A great absence of ordinary magic. I'd felt that before, at the Cooper townhouse, before Punch took a father and annihilated a family. Now what if that was what Punch was? The ghost of a god. Literally the spirit of riot and rebellion. That was a long way to jump from a mysterious chest wound. Still, the case did give me an excuse to investigate. I asked where Olivia and Phoebe were now.
"At Mama Thames' house in Wapping," said Nightingale.
"And Tyburn?"
"Still missing."
"But not dead. At least, not according to Beverly." "We'd know," she said, when I called and asked. "Mum would know." "But if not dead, then what?"
"Hunting," said Beverly, "in her own way."
So I went hunting too, also in my own way, by adopting the ancient and traditional stance of the lazy copper, which is in front of his Aware terminal with a double-shot latte and a jumbo-sized pack of prawn cocktail-flavored crisps. I had to hunch up a bit because Gulid was using her own terminal to compile a classically mealy-mouthed Falcon case report. "Okay," she said. "We say he was armed, but what do we say he was armed with?" "If you put, knowing he was likely armed, that covers a multitude of sins," I said.
"Armed with what?"
"Weapons with Falcon characteristics."
"You know, one day this is all going to come out in the open."
"Don't worry. You'll be chief super by then."
"Not if I keep writing reports like this."
"Got him," I said.
"Got who?"
asked Galeed.
"Zachary Palmer is a skinny little white boy who is probably half something exotic, which makes him a useful contact when I want to know what's going on in the Demi-Wand, e.g. where some red-headed fox might be hiding. Less useful of late, because he's been making himself purposely unavailable on account of him at one time being Leslie May's lover. We all suspect he still is, or rather, we think she turns up every so often and bangs his brains out. She wouldn't be stupid enough to settle into anything regular or permanent, nothing that will get her caught. There was a time when tracking him down would have involved more legwork than I'd care to expend, but since the business with the underground pigs, don't ask, he'd become semi-respectable, working as liaison for the quiet people with Crossrail project managers. That meant regular pay, which these days means a bank account, which we've had passively monitored as part of Operation Cart Horse, the hunt for Leslie. I used to worry that he'd sussed us out because of the way he'd withdraw large amounts of cash and then live off that for a couple of weeks. But soon the siren call of instant card payment caught up with him. And now he chips and pins like the rest of us. I scanned his transactions and noted some regular payments to a branch of Greg's on Kilburn High Road at the same time every afternoon. After that, it was a simple matter of borrowing a pool car and having my coffee out. The only car available was a bloody silver Astra, which was so obviously an unmarked police car that it might as well have had an orange Bill on Board sticker in the rear window. So I parked it round the corner, and after picking up a coffee and steak slice for myself, I took my place at the bus stop opposite. Bus stops are great temporary stops for surveillance, since they give you a legitimate reason to be standing around looking bored, and the ad shell shelters you from the rain. Despite the weather, the high road was heaving with school kids, mums, buggies, and people out shopping. Given the rain, I'd swapped out my suit jacket for my stakeout hoodie, which rendered me effectively invisible. Given that Zach's attitude towards punctuality had always been one of stunned incomprehension, the time of his daily transactions were remarkably consistent. I suspected that he was on his break from a job. If so, it was amazing he'd held it for the 3 weeks he'd been making the pickups. 5 days having been the longest he'd previously held a job for, at least that we had records about. Right on time, I spotted him coming up the street from the direction of the station. He was the same skinny wretch, hands jammed in the pockets of his worn jeans, and, like me, hoodied up against the rain and random CCTV in grey Adidas. I thought he was going to walk right past me, but before he reached the bus shelter, he turned sharply and skipped across the road to the Greggs. I scoffed the last of my steak slice as I waited for him to come back out. I'd been planning to catch him in the queue, but now I was curious to know what he was up to. Whatever it was, it seemed to involve 3 large carrier bags worth of food. Not even Zach, I thought, can eat that much, or at least not in one go. I followed him round the corner and down Belsize Road, which runs beside the railway tracks, and is one of those places where you can see the industrial heritage of London being swiftly gentrified into luxury offices for hire. Although this process hadn't quite reached the ramshackle collection of one-story garages halfway down the street on the railway side. Zach stopped outside the side door, turned, and waited for me to catch up.
"You can come in," he said, "but you've got to keep your voice down."
Inside, it was obvious that despite the garage doors at the front, the place had originally been built as a workshop with a pitched wrought iron glass roof designed to let in all the thrifty late Victorian sunlight to save on gas. Age and neglect had yellowed the glass to near opacity, except the far end where it had obviously recently been cleaned. The bare brick walls had been whitewashed and then painted pastel shades of pink, green and yellow. There were bookshelves in one corner, a line of sinks and a wet area in another. Underfoot was industrial grade lino and easy to clean carpeting in green and brown. Munchkin-sized chairs and tables sprouted in little clusters. A mural on one wall caught my eye. A depiction of an orangutan sitting at a reading lectern in the style of Paul Kidby. The group of 10 or 12 children inside was not a surprise, nor the fact that, having spotted Zach and his armfuls of goodies, they surged forward like a sugar-starved tidal wave. What was a surprise
was that they did it in almost total silence. They were the children of the quiet people, the people who lived under Notting Hill and Ladbroke Grove, pale-skinned and big-eyed, and not normally seen above ground. Many of them had pale blonde hair that had not yet darkened to their usual light brown. As I watched them being marshalled into their assigned seats, all the while stealing glances at Zack as he unpacked the bags, I found myself trying really hard not to think of a brick wall. The young woman marshalling the children was similarly slender and pale, with chestnut-coloured hair in a neat French plait down her back. She'd obviously discovered the joys and practicality of skinny jeans, but above the waist she wore a pale yellow high-collared blouse and waistcoat. She was wearing dark glasses indoors, although I realized her charges were not. Zack had his bags open and was laying out neat plates of rhubarb and custard doughnuts, Belgian buns, and iced fingers on undecorated earthenware plates that were beautiful in the simplicity of their curves. There was a low, gurgling rumbling, loud in the unnatural quiet of the nursery. Zack's stomach. A ripple ran through the children, a whisper of laughter that passed from child to child. Their teacher gave Zack an indulgent smile, and he gave a little wave back. Then I recognized her, Elizabeth Tentance, whose father was king of the quiet people, or if not king, then lead gangmaster, or chief mining engineer, or something like that. She was strict. She made those kids wait patiently until everything was ready, and then line up neatly to receive their one goodie and one mug of milk from Zack, who beamed like Father Christmas through the whole thing.
"The idea," said Zack, "is to get them used to the sunlight."
The kids had finished their snack, and me and Zack were hoovering up the leftovers while Elizabeth Tentons read them a story at the other end of the nursery.
"Are they planning to move to the surface?" I asked.
"Don't be daft,"
said Zack.
"But they are looking at acquiring a bit of real estate to serve as an official address."
And then, no doubt, connect it up to the warren of tunnels they had running under Notting Hill. It was a clever idea, since it allowed the quiet people to bureaucratically integrate themselves into society without giving up their freedom to apply Victorian health and safety standards to their work underground.
"Whose idea was this?"
"Your mate, Lady Tyes," said Zack,
and explained that she'd also smoothed the way with Ofsted and Camden Council to get the necessary permissions and permits. I've had similar dealings with Camden, so I know that couldn't have been easy. I looked over at the kids. It was a sensible, pragmatic solution to the problem of integrating the quiet people into society. And if those kids started to prefer living above ground, going to uni in far-off exotic places like Reading and Cambridge, and marrying out of the tribe? Well then, after a while the whole problem just fades away, doesn't it? Along with the memories of the old people, and the unwritten histories. The silence would reign in the galleries of their forefathers. Not that they were exactly noisy now.
"I'm not going to tell you where she is," said Zack suddenly.
This caused me some confusion, until I worked out he was talking about Leslie. "Is she all right?" I asked.
"What?"
"Is she all right?" I asked. "Is she okay?"
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Considering, you know, one thing or the other, all things being equal."
Zack thought he had something to hide, which meant Zack probably was in contact with Leslie on a regular basis. Good, I thought, because soon it'll be time to pull on that thread and see where it goes. But not today. Because first, there was Mr. Fossman.
"I want to know about Reynard," I said.
Zack hesitated. I could practically hear him weighing up whether to pretend he didn't know and then thinking better of him.
"What about him?"
he asked.
"I need to know where he is."
"What for?"
"Because the faceless man wants him dead."
"He's probably already dead then."
"Not if I can help it."
Zack licked his lips and glanced over at Elizabeth Tentons before dropping his voice so low I had to lean in to hear him.
"Is it true you know his real name now?"
I said nothing because if I told Zack, I might as well announce it on Facebook.
"Have you checked his gaff?"
I said not only had we checked his gaff, we'd spun his drum and his crib as well, and that we had his ends so thoroughly staked out that street crime had dropped by 20% overnight. I want to know where he goes as a last resort, Zach told me.
You're shitting me, I said. No lie. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
That's the nature of the beast, said Zach.
We are what we are.
Chapter 14. A Walk in the Park.
The Fox Club,
said Nightingale when I called him. In Mayfair, I said.
Well, at least he's consistent.
He's brown bread if we don't get to him first, I said.
Let's see if we can avoid that outcome, said Nightingale.
Occasionally, when the mood takes us, the police can react very fast to unforeseen events. So we had a surveillance perimeter set up in less than 30 minutes with a pair of PCs in plain clothes inside the club. One of them was PC Omar Kabat from the Mounted Branch, whose legendary good looks meant that nobody ever believes he's police. Is it true he nearly got arrested while in full uniform? Gulid asked. Since Reynard knew me, her and Nightingale, we'd been placed around the corner from the Fox Club, which was just as well, since we were in the Silver Astra with the My Other Car's an IRV bumper sticker. That's what I heard, I said. Rumour had it that Kubat plus Horse had been deployed as crowd control during the Olympics when a local inspector had got it into his head that Kubat was an actor involved in an illegal film shoot. Didn't believe him, I said, not even when he handed over his warrant card. It was a quality that meant Kubat was constantly getting poached for side jobs like ours, although his duty inspector made it clear that anybody, regardless of the rank, who tried to transfer him out of Mounted Branch was going to wake up with a bed full of horse product. The Fox Club, for all its aspirations and Mayfair address, was less an exclusive gentleman's club and more an expensive bar with some posh hotel rooms attached. Kubat was probably a bit too good-looking for its usual clientele, but at least if he were mistaken for something, it wouldn't be an undercover police officer. The club occupied a Regency Terrace on a street just off Piccadilly, less than 200 metres from Lady Tye's house and almost on top of the underground course of her river. Curzon Street, to the north, was still partially closed as the fire brigade and Thames Water dealt with the flood damage. I didn't think it was a coincidence, and the chance that Lady Tye was also using Reynard as bait had been factored into our operational plan, such as it was, and our risk assessment, such as that was. Me, Gulid and Nightingale were designated Alpha. David Carey and a couple of guys from Belgravia MIT were in Charlie, covering Half Moon Street at the back of the club. A couple of PCs in plain clothes, on ruinous levels of overtime, were in what any other Nick would call Bravo, but inexplicably Belgravia MIT always called the banana car. I asked them why, and nobody could remember. Stephanopoulos and Seawall were trying to rustle up some armed response, but apparently there was some anti-terror operation currently live in East London, so we couldn't count on getting them until that was done. Kubat called to report that he had eyes on Reynard. At a table in the main saloon, he said. He's holding some chairs free too. He must be expecting someone. Nightingale told him to hold position, and we heard him order a pint of lager. A pint is a good drink for undercover work since, unlike a short, you can get away with drinking it slowly. It has low alcohol by volume, and if you keep moving it about, people can't tell how much you're drinking. I suggested that we grab Reynard then and there, but Nightingale said wait.
I don't think we've played out the line fully yet, he said.
Poor Reynard, I thought. Demoted from fox to fish. He must have done something shitty in a former life. Although, how it could be worse than what he was doing in his current life took some imagining. You don't often end up thinking strange things when you're on a stakeout. Nightingale was proved right when we got a call from the banana car saying they had eyeballs on an older IC1 and a younger IC3 female heading for the club. I asked whether the IC3 female was over 6 feet tall. Definitely, said the banana car.
I thought this might happen, said Nightingale. Lady Helena is still trying to secure the third Principia for herself.
Shall we stop them?
Nightingale hesitated, tapping his finger on the steering wheel. No, he said finally. If I'm right, then Mr. Flossman will either hand it over directly or take them to it.
And if Martin surely crashes the trade?
Lady Helena is more than capable of defending herself and her daughter, said Nightingale, or at least of fending him off for long enough so that we can sweep in heroically, like the 7th Cavalry.
Burning teepees and shooting women and children, I thought. And with that cheerful notion, I had a root around in the stakeout bag Molly had provided. One of the rat sandwiches had a large H written on the outside. I handed it to Gleed, as the rest were all unmarked. I played potluck and got a suspiciously mundane ham salad sandwich. Nightingale said he'd have his later. Kubat reported that Lady Helena and her daughter had arrived.
They sat down at his table, he said. He doesn't seem surprised to see them.
Nightingale asked if they'd ordered drinks.
Not yet, said Kubat.
Whatever happens, do not engage, said Nightingale. If there's a Falcon incident, you may lose radio contact. Don't panic. Don't engage the targets. Instead, I want you to concentrate on evacuating the civilians.
Kubat acknowledged and Nightingale contacted Seawall, who was Gold Commander for the operation.
Alexander, can you get some men looking for Lady Helena's car? He said, and rattled off the index from memory. Once they have located it, can you disable it in some fashion?
Seawall said they could do better than that, and have vehicle recovery lift it onto one of their flatbeds and drive it away.
That should limit their options, said Nightingale.
Kubat reported that the older IC-1 female and Reynard Fossman were having an argument, albeit conducted in angry whispers. The IC-3 female, on the other hand, was looking bored and indifferent.
Well, if this continues, said Nightingale, they might just scoop them all up when they find their car is missing.
3 minutes later, I got a call from an unlisted number. It was Special Agent Kimberly Reynolds.
Do you want the good news or the bad news? She asked.
Bad, I said, and put her on speaker.
One of our virgins let slip some information while I was debriefing them, she said. We think there's a second team operating in London, and we think they might have been tasked with the apprehension of Reynard Fossman.
I would have sworn loudly, but Kimberly had some views about blasphemy, and I like to be polite.
You're cussing, aren't you? She said after a moment. Well, stop it because you don't have the time. We think they're running an operation right now, in and around Mayfair.
Damn, said Nightingale. That's inconvenient.
I wanted to know who we were. I suspected Kimberly was drawing on support from both the FBI and the NSA, but it's not like she would tell me if she was, and I didn't have time to ask.
And the good news?
I asked.
We think it's a small team, said Kimberly. 4 people, tops.
Agent Reynolds? Said Nightingale.
Sir?
Could you liaise with DCI Seawall, who is Gold Commander on this op?
Nightingale's voice had got very precise and clipped.
I trust you've informed CTC?
Kittredge was with me for the interview, sir, she said.
Good, said Nightingale. That should speed things up. Is there anything further your people can contribute?
I'm afraid not, sir, said Kimberly. Although there may be more intelligence forthcoming.
Very good, said Nightingale. Carry on, Agent Reynolds, and keep us apprised.
American intelligence, said Gleed once the phone was safely off.
Forewarned is forearmed, said Nightingale.
I asked if it wouldn't be better to cut our losses and grab Reynard, Lady Helena, and Caroline before the situation got more complicated. As a rule, the more complex a situation gets, the more likely the wheels are to come off. This is why the police strategy with a large crowd is to pin them in place until everyone's too desperate for the loo to cause trouble.
No, said Nightingale. We're going to adopt a flexible doctrine. If we spot the Americans, we'll see if CTC can't round them up without disturbing our principles. If Reynard leads us to his hiding place and Martin Chorley makes an appearance, we shall deal with that mob while CTC fends off the Americans.
Flexible, I said. Meaning we're making up as we go along?
Quite, said Nightingale.
There was a click on the airwave. It was Kubat. They're heading for the door, he said.
Hand off to Banana Car, said Nightingale.
Banana car, stay in position and tell me where they go.
The answer was south, towards Piccadilly and Green Park. Suddenly Nightingale was pulling out of our parking space and accelerating fast enough to push us back hard into our seats. He swung a sudden left into Half Moon Street, while simultaneously ordering Banana Car to shift position to the Bomber Command Memorial and await further instructions. Charlie Car was to drop two of its watches off on the Knightsbridge side of Hyde Park Corner.
"And drive carefully," said Nightingale. "I don't want you drawing attention to yourselves."
I hung on grimly to the door handle as he braked hard just short of the corner with Piccadilly and wished he'd taken his own advice. We pulled into an insanely unlikely free parking spot, and Nightingale looked over and told me to cross Piccadilly and take a position inside the park gate.
"Get yourself 20 yards behind the targets and follow them," he said. "Gulid and I will follow 10 yards behind you."
"The targets all know him," said Gulid.
"They know Peter Grant, the dashing constable about town," said Nightingale. "In his sweat top, they'll take him for an averagely delinquent youth."
He stabbed a finger in the direction of the park.
"Off you go. We'll be right behind you."
A low cloud had drawn in over London, and with it, an early twilight. There'd been rain earlier, and the smell of wet leaves mingled with the car exhaust. The traffic on Piccadilly was slow, and it was easy enough to nip across, vault the safety railings, and slip in through the gates. Green Park had been laid down by Charles II, who nicked the land off a local farmer, laid out the paths, and installed an ice house so that he'd never be short of a cool drink after a hard day of amateur theatre. It stayed on the fringes of the city, where it served as a convenient open space for midnight liaisons and the occasional spot of highway robbery. It takes pride these days in being the dullest park in London, and is noticeably short of shrubs, bushes, kiosks, statues, or anything else a dashing constable about town might hide behind. I should have welcomed the thick mist that seeped in between the upright tree trunks, hazing the streetlights and beading my shoulders and the edge of my hood with droplets of water. But I didn't, because I recognized that mist. I'd seen it roll up the Thames when Father and Mama held their spring court on the South Bank, and the course of the Tyburn ran through Green Park on its way to Buckingham Palace. I keyed my airwave. "Tyburn's about," I said, my voice dulled by the moisture in the air.
"So I see," said Nightingale. "Our fox is certainly living up to his reputation. I doubt Martin Chorley will risk entering the park while she's on the warpath. Reynard's safe while he stays in there."
"I can't see them," I said.
"Southeast of your position," said Nightingale. 30 yards and heading south."
I stuck my hands in my pockets and slouched off down the path while trying to think delinquent thoughts. They were a distinctive bunch, so I spotted them walking briskly across the grass toward the center of the park. I picked up my pace, lifting my knees as if I was doing running practice. I figured I'd look kosher if I stayed on the path. I was crossing their path at a tangent, and as I reached the closest approach, I forced myself to keep my eyes forward. With luck, even if they looked, my face would be hidden by my hoodie. Where could they be heading? South was Constitution Hill Road, notable for not being much of a hill, and just beyond that, the walled gardens of Buckingham Palace. Once they hit the road, they could go east towards Victoria Memorial and the Mall, or west, up the hill to Hyde Park Corner. In my earpiece, I could hear Nightingale calmly ordering units into position around the park, while maintaining his position behind me and working without a map. The mist was thickening. The trees that lined the path I was on were flattening out and fading. 10 meters further down the path, I risked a look and saw that Reynard and co. had changed direction. Now they were heading downslope to the east. I turned off the path, but stayed at a tangent so I wouldn't be obviously following them. But I had to close the distance before they were swallowed up in the mist and darkness. I reported the change in direction.
"You're going to have to risk getting closer," said Nightingale.
I heard a snarl off to my left, and I didn't think it was a dog. I looked. I thought I saw movement in the mist, man-shaped, but loping like a big cat, picking up momentum as it ran after my targets. I was about to call it in
when a long, thin shape hissed over my shoulder and slammed into the running figure, which went tumbling with a yowling scream. A naked man ran past me and did a sort of hopping turn to face me. His long, rangy body was smeared in blue paint, and he held a pair of spears in his left hand. His hair was a spray of spiky black, and gold gleamed at his throat and wrists.
"Did you see that?"
he shouted.
"Tell me you saw that. That's got to be worth a song."
He turned and ran off, shouting over his shoulder,
"Or at least a memory."
It sounded almost plaintive. And then, with just a few steps, he was gone. I checked Reynard and the others, but they were still walking calmly in the direction of Hyde Park Corner. Either they were the most focused people on Earth, or that encounter had been a lot quieter than I thought it was. "Boss," I said into my airwave, "it's getting needlessly metaphysical out here."
"Ignore it," said Nightingale calmly. "There's more than one conflict going on at the moment, but only one of them is your concern."
I realized that despite having two of the busiest roads in London within 100 meters, the rush hour had faded to nothing. From behind me, I heard a stamping, grunting sound and a noise like pots and pans being rhythmically smacked together. A growl, a shout, a scream. "Stay on target," I thought. "They're definitely heading for Hyde Park Corner," I said. Nightingale said that he and Gulid were going to get ahead of them, and that I was going to be on my own, but I should be quite safe.
"As long as you stay focused," he said.
Which was easier said than done, because that's when early Tyburn returned. I smelt him before I heard him. The copper smell of fresh blood and old sweat, wood smoke and wet dog.
"You should listen to your master," said a voice by my ear. "He's a cunning man. By the way, did you see that sick cast right through the neck? Never saw it coming. Worth a song, right? Bit of an impromptu beatbox, maybe?"
"What's with the woad?" I asked. "Last time we met, you were all medieval." Out on the mists, the trees had multiplied, and the straight London plains and lime trees were sharing space with the shadowy ghosts of oak, beech and poplar.
"Just being true to my roots, fam,"
said the former incarnation of the god of the River Tyburn. Or maybe a hallucination brought on by way too many supernatural wankers messing with my head, or possibly both at the same time. I kept my eyes on my targets ahead, and my hoodie was as effective as any pair of blinkers, so I almost screamed when I felt him slip his arm round my shoulders, the spare javelins in his left hand clacking against my arm, the tips pushing into my peripheral vision. I felt my balls and my stomach tighten, the anticipation for action when you run down a deer in the King's Forest, or jack a motor from outside a gaff in Primrose Hill. The defiance of power making the meat taste so much sweeter, the slip into first gear and away so much sweeter. "I saw your father," I said. "He seemed a happy little Roman."
"And so he was," said the voice. "But we are not always the sons our fathers dream of, as you should know."
And I did know. And all the things sons do to make their fathers proud, until you learn to choose your own life for your own reasons. Have your own money, your own car, your own job, your own place, your own life, and fuck everybody else. What have they ever done for you? But I'd felt this seduction before. Or something like it. On a tube train between Camden and Kentish Town, when old Mr. Punch tried to recruit me for Team Riot, and I knew how well that had turned out in the end.
"Lady Ty must be a real disappointment," I said.
The arm squeezed my shoulders and relaxed its grip.
"Why don't you ask her about the Marquis in 76, the bin bag dress, and how she couldn't quite bring herself to push the safety pin all the way through," said the voice.
And before I could reply, he was gone. With him went the concealing mist, and suddenly I was standing by the Boris bike stand at the far end of Green Park, and listening to the angry traffic fighting its way around Hyde Park Corner.
Hyde Park Corner is what happens when a bunch of urban planners take one look at the grinding circle of gridlock that surrounds the Arc de Triomphe in Paris and think, that's what we want for our town. Inspired, no doubt, by the existence of the Wellington Arch, George IV's cut price copy of Napoleon's own vanity project, they wrapped seven lanes of traffic around one corner of Green Park, ran a dual carriageway underneath, and produced virtually overnight what had taken the French and Baron Haussmann 100 years to perfect. I scanned right to left and spotted Reynard, Lady Helena, and Caroline waiting for the lights to change at the Pelican Crossing. There was enough of a crowd to allow me to cross right after them with just a bit of a last-minute dash against the red man. Ahead of us was the Wellington Arch, with Europe's largest bronze statue thoughtfully plonked on top to avoid people getting a good look at it. Nike, goddess of victory, riding the chariot of war, driven by a boy racer. There used to be a mini police station built into the arch, which would have been bloody useful right now, but they closed it down in the 90s. It was full night by the time I crossed the street, and the Portland stone of the arch was bleached white by spotlights, the bronze on top lit up in blue. I let Reynard and his party gain some distance as they passed to the right of the structure. In my earpiece, I could hear Nightingale calmly positioning spotters to cover the tube station and all the crossings. They're heading for Hyde Park, I told him, and then remembered Reynard's left-hand drive Renault 4 that we'd never located. Maybe because it was stashed in a car park somewhere, maybe the one beneath Hyde Park, the one with a reputed tunnel to the chestnut tree. I floated the idea past Nightingale and heard Gulid groan in the background. Nightingale punted it up to Seawall to get some bodies down to the car park to check. If it had been sitting there all this time, we were all going to look stupid come case review. But at least we might get there before Reynard. If they were going for the car park, then they'd cross the road and head north up Park Lane, or more likely walk along the parallel bridle path. I veered to the left, with the idea of running through the arch and closing the distance with Reynard, when a young white woman caught my eye. She was slender but toned, with strong legs and shoulders, under mauve designer jeans and a matching suede jacket. Her face was round and smooth with a snub nose and rosebud lips. Her hair was dark brown and cut into a pixie bob. A pair of pretentious, round-framed, smoked glass spectacles hid her eyes. She caught me looking and tilted her head in amused recognition, before turning and walking away on unexpectedly sensible flat shoes. I knew that walk. A brisk, business-like walk. A walk to cover the distance quickly without looking hurried or worried. I keyed my airwave. "I've just seen Leslie at the arch," I said. "Are you certain?" asked Nightingale. "The face is different, but it's definitely Leslie," I said. "Is it a mask?" asked Nightingale. "No," I said. "Not a mask." "Did she see you?" "Yes." "Arrest her," said Nightingale. "Now." I was wearing trainers. You can run really quietly in trainers if you have to. It's all in the way you roll your feet. I took off as fast as I could, straight for her back. I knew sooner or later she was going to check on my position, but I was counting on her Leslie-esque sense of drama to hold the moment longer than she should. I was 3 meters short when a white guy in a navy suit jacket over a black Metallica t-shirt theatrically jumped out of my way and yelled, "Look out!" The woman who walked like Leslie turned and I saw the look of surprise on her face. Then I stumbled as the pale skin of her face rippled and her features changed. It started at the bridge of her nose, the skin bunching up, then flopping down horribly, like the wings of a manta or the shroud of a squid. Then suddenly it was Leslie's face again, or rather the smooth pink version of it I'd seen in the Harrods Jazz Cafe. I was so shocked that I barely registered the raised hand and the shimmer in the air that signaled pain inbound. I forced myself to lengthen my stumble into a fall and a clumsy roll, taking the impact on my shoulders as something shot through the space I would have been in, with a noise like my mum beating a carpet. As I climbed to my feet and dodged right on general principles, I heard yells behind me. I had the airwave off by then and didn't dare turn it back on to alert Nightingale to potential collateral. I had to trust his professional instincts and hoped that Leslie wasn't flinging anything too lethal around. She knew better than to escalate in public in central London, not unless she wanted to take a run up that short ladder that ended with making a personal relationship with the Special Air Service. I ran through the arch, making my appearance as abrupt as I could, and spotted Leslie heading off towards the Wellington Memorial. She was walking briskly rather than running, hoping, I assumed, to avoid drawing attention to herself. I flicked an Impello at her and felt a moment of mad satisfaction as it knocked her legs out from under her. As I ran to close the distance, I pulled my asp from the belly pocket of my hoodie and flicked it out to full length, but she rolled and was on her feet before I got halfway there. She raised her hand. I saw a flash and got my shield up in time to deflect it into the air. I've been training to conjure my shield with an upward slope for use amongst the general public. You don't want anything eldritch or even mundanely pointy ricocheting into innocent bystanders. Leslie switched direction and headed for the right of the plinth that held up 40 tons of mounted military legend. So I went around it on the left just in case she planned an ambush, which is how we came to run smack into each other. I'm bigger, so she went backwards, but not before her forehead hit me hard enough in the mouth to loosen one filling and make me taste blood. I swung my baton but missed, and she kicked me in the thigh, which was probably a lucky miss. Then she hit me with something Impello-ish which knocked me over backwards, but Nightingale has trained me to accept the direction of the blow and roll up so that I regain my feet as quickly as possible. So far, this was all suspiciously non-lethal. Not that I was complaining, mind you, but we were escalating enough for the streetlights and spots around us to fizz out. I flung a water bomb in Leslie's general direction, but she ducked back behind the plinth, and I dared not charge after her in case she was waiting around the corner with something unpleasant. I went wide and caught sight of her vaulting a waist-high stone parapet behind the monument and dropping onto the ramp below. I leaned over and watched as she ran down towards the pedestrian subway. I considered following, but instead darted back and ran down the nearby stairs instead, just in case she tried to double back that way. Hyde Park Corner has some of the cleanest pedestrian subways in the world. This one was decorated with colourful murals depicting the Battle of Waterloo, just in case any French tourists had some doubt about whose capital they were visiting. This time, I went for speed and got within 2 meters, but she grabbed a startled tourist, swung him around as if dancing, and threw him down in front of me. I had to break stride to jump, and that gave Leslie enough time to cut right down another passage. I cornered it myself in time to see her skid left and vanish into the ticket office. I followed slower, risking a peek around the corner to avoid any sudden surprises. Hyde Park Corner has a tiny ticket office, and Leslie was already through the barrier. She turned to check whether I was following, and that's when I knew I was being played. Still, I charged the barriers to drive her down the escalators, but I didn't follow. Instead, waving my warrant card to reassure the underground staff, I veered right and back out into the subway. Turning my airwave back on, I ran up the stairs and found myself at the entrance to Hyde Park. I did a 360 scan while waiting for the airwave to boot up. We used to wait for our electronics to warm up. Now it's our software. But there was no sight of any of the targets. Finally, the airwave connected and I got Nightingale. "It's a feint," I said. "Leslie was trying to draw me away, which means wherever they're going is close." And then I looked down Knightsbridge to where the Oriental Hotel was painted a warm orange by its spotlights. "It's One High Park," I said. "Tell me you have spotters there already." "But of course," said Nightingale, "and I believe you may be right." "What makes you say that?" "Reynard and our friends have just walked in the front door," he said. We waited for screams, but none came. That was almost worse. All of the apartment windows were dark, and Seawall was 90% sure that most of the super-rich inhabitants of One Hyde Park were either temporarily not in residence or still living abroad and waiting for property prices in London to peak. Stephanopoulos and some uniforms in full public order kit had sealed off the tunnel from the Oriental Hotel
But David Carey, interviewing staff, was pretty sure at least one group had made it in before it was locked down.
4 IC-1 males in suits, he reported. That will be the Americans, said Nightingale.
There were reports of burst water mains and flooding from Sloane Street and the Serpentine. I checked my notebook. All along the course of the Westbourne, whose genius loci was otherwise known as Chelsea Thames. I called Beverly and asked her if she knew where her younger sister was.
Here at Mum's, she said, hiding under Leah's bed.
I don't suppose Tyburn's popped in for a visit, I asked. Beverly said no, and told me whatever I thought I was going to do next, I was to be careful. Always, I said.
I mean it, she said.
Tyburn's probably in there as well, I said, after I hung up.
Full house, said Galeed.
We'd escalated up to having a mobile control room, codenamed Broadway, which was parked on South Carriage Drive with a good view of the back of One Hyde Park. The key advantage of a mobile control room is that it gave Seawall a place to shout at us while sitting in a comfy chair with a cup of tea. Luckily for us, the postmodern obsession with transparent walls meant that in One Hyde Park, nobody could move around the access stairs or lifts without being seen by the spotter teams Nightingale had positioned in the buildings opposite. We'd closed off South Carriage Drive and pushed a perimeter back 20 meters to the south, but Seawall was reluctant to close Knightsbridge and Old Brompton because the rush hour was still tailing off. We had about 20 to 30 minutes before the media tweaked that a major police operation had descended on the most expensive bit of real estate in London. Galeed suggested that we leave them in there and arrest the survivors, which earned her a pleased smile from Seawall, but then he shook his head.
Somebody, he said, eyeing Nightingale, is going to have to go in there and clean up the mess.
Quite, said Nightingale and looked at me. Peter?
Noisy or quiet? I asked.
Oh, quiet, said Nightingale.
And so it was decided. But not before me and Galeed climbed into our PSU overalls and after a bit of an argument, donned the shin and elbow guards. We didn't bother with the helmets, but Galeed swapped her hijab for a fire-resistant hood that made her look like she was about to climb into a Soyuz rocket. Practical and modest, I said, and she grinned. Needless to say, we both put our MET vests on and loaded ourselves down with CS spray, speed cuffs. I even considered packing a taser, which I'm now authorized and trained to carry, but they just tend to complicate things. Finally, Nightingale handed me a stave of varnished wood, the size and shape of a pickaxe handle, one end wrapped in canvas strips, the other capped with iron. Branded into the side was a 6-digit number and the hammer and anvil sigil of the legendary Sons of Wayland. As I gripped it, I felt the hum of the hive and sunlight amongst the hills and hedgerows. Once more into the breach, I thought. We paraded round the back of the mobile control center. Seawall rolled his eyes at the sight of us, but said nothing. Nightingale was dressed in a leather sapper's coat, but thank God not the breeches that went with it. He had donned a pair of serious army boots that had probably only not perished with age because Molly wasn't going to let any of his clothes die on her watch, damn it. He caught Galeed's eye.
Sara, he said, things are likely to get somewhat esoteric before the end, and this is not something you're trained for. I can't, in all conscience, ask you to join us.
If it's all the same to you, sir, I think I'm gonna have to see this through, she said. Inshallah.
As God wills it.
Good show,
said Nightingale. This is it, I thought. We're all gonna die. Chapter 15, State 6. A risk assessment is a key part of modern policing. Before diving into whatever crisis is at hand, the modern plot is expected to ask themselves, given the modalities of the current situation, would any intervention by myself help promote a positive outcome going forward? And what are the chances of this going well and truly pear-shaped? And if it does, how likely is it that I will get the blame? Some people think this makes us risk-averse,
but I like to point out that a risk assessment is what blonde teenagers don't do before heading downstairs into the basement in a slasher movie. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't go down to investigate, but I'd bloody well make sure I was wearing a stab vest first and had some backup, preferably going down the stairs ahead of me. I reckon that Sewell and Nightingale's risk assessment was sound for several reasons. We couldn't just let them kill each other, tempting though that was, because we didn't know how many members of the public were currently in the complex. The owners might not be in residence, but there could still be staff inside, and they counted as people too. That said, there was no point sending in TSG or even SCO-19 because Martin Chorley would just hand their asses back to them. That made it a Falcon job. And since Nightingale was the most Falcon-capable officer in the Met, I was the second, and God help her, Gulid was the third. We were the logical people to deal. So in we went, through the back garden, past the statues of the two flattened empty heads, and entered the wrong way through an emergency fire exit at the base of one of the towers. Now, personally, I'd have been happier driving an armored personnel carrier in through the front door, but since we're the Met, and not the police department of a small town in Missouri, we didn't have one. I keep my airwave one last time before shutting it down. "This is Falcon 2," I said. "Show us State 6, meaning officers at the scene. Like I said, One Hyde Park had four pavilions with four towers containing lifts and stairs interspersed between them. Two were for residents and two were for service staff, because times might move on, but the gentry still like their servants to be invisible. Despite the transparent walls, the soundproofing was good, and there was no hint of traffic noise as we stepped out into the wide, curved hallway that ran the length of the ground floor. The lights were still on, a good sign, and we could see all the way down three levels of the basement and up to the top floor of Pavilions 1 and 2. Me and Gulid held our position while Nightingale padded off down the hallway to secure the eastern end. There were exclusive shops for the excessively over-resourced on the ground floor of each of the pavilions. Nightingale checked the internal doors leading to them to make sure they were secure and free of supernatural taint before moving on. The curve meant that we lost sight of him when he reached the far end of the hallway. Me and Gulid tucked ourselves into what cover we could find amongst the rent-a-culture statuary and waited. There was a strong smell of lemon floor polish. Gulid looked abstracted while she listened through her earpiece to the airwave chatter. Since she wasn't likely to fly her own equipment, she'd been designated communications officer or, as Nightingale put it, radio man for the op. "Stephanopoulos is in," she said. It was Stephanopoulos's job to secure the service hub at the eastern end of the complex so that we could evacuate civilians out that way as well. Once Nightingale had declared the ground floor shops Falcon free, she'd go door to door and evacuate them. The big debate during the planning stage had been whether to then go up and check Martin Chorley's flat, down to check the basement and underground parking area, or head west to clear the entrance foyer. I signalled Gulid and pointed upstairs, but she shook her head. No reports of movement there. When Nightingale trotted back to our position, he repeated my query, and, getting the same answer, led us off towards the foyer, where we found our first casualty. He was stretched out, half on the shiny grey marble and half on the fine silk-weave grey carpet in front of the granite reception desk. Nightingale caught my attention, pointed, and then put two fingers against his throat. As he watched the balcony, I scuttled over to do a first aid assessment. I recognized the guy. He was the dark-skinned man in the good suit that I'd seen first time I visited. I'd had him pegged as security, and indeed he was holding a compact digital walkie-talkie, as used by police, film crews, and paramilitary death squads the world over. I shifted my staff to my left hand and found a pulse in his neck. There were no other obvious injuries, so I gently rolled him into the recovery position. I picked up his walkie-talkie and shook it. It sounded like a rainmaker, with loose bits and sand rattling around inside. Nightingale signaled Gulid, who spoke quietly into her airwave and nodded to me. I trotted over to the main entrance to make sure it was open. Then I retreated back to Nightingale and maintained watch while a trio of TSG guys in full riot gear clattered in with a pair of London Ambulance paramedics in tow. The paramedics were public order specialists and had their own riot gear, only their helmets were painted green, presumably to confuse rioters for long enough for them to do their jobs. As the paramedics went to work, Nightingale signaled to two of the TSG to take position behind the reception desk, while a third escorted the paramedics. The TSG were under strict instructions not to engage anyone, but to contain and report. Satisfied that the foyer was locked down, Nightingale led us up a set of grey marble stairs and onto the first floor. Here, there was another curved hallway linking the pavilions and the access towers. The flats on these levels were all one or two bedroom and mainly owned by shell companies and investment portfolios, what Seawall called corporate jolly pads, and he really didn't need to emphasize that jolly much to illustrate his meaning. Still, they had to be cleared just like the shops. Me and Gulid held the stairwell again, while Nightingale did his witch-sniffing thing before signaling Stephanopoulos that her people could go door to door. Now, I'd wanted to go straight downstairs to the underground car park because, apart from the thought that Reynard might have stashed his car down there, each flat came not only with its own parking space, but with an underground storage locker the size of a standard shipping container. But Seawall had pointed out that we still had a duty of care to people in the building, and that had to be our priority. And strangely, Peter, we fucking thought to check it during the investigation. It being the storage space associated with Martin Chorley's flat. But not for the Renault 4, because we didn't know about Reynard's car then. We'd been inside One Hyde Park for over 20 minutes by now, and I'd expected screams after 10. The kickoff was suspiciously late. Martin Chorley had spent the last 2 years psyching us, from sending a pale lady to distract me from the murder in West End Central, to Leslie's bit of bait and switch that very afternoon at Hyde Park Corner. I figured the very next thing that happened was going to be a feint too. And so did Nightingale. Because when Seawall told us that the spotters had seen the lights go on in the Chorley apartment 3 floors above, he sent me and Gulid down to check the garage while he went up. Had we managed to make it all the way down to the cars immediately, things might have gone differently. But we ran straight into the Americans on the first sub-level. Below ground, the stairs reverted to standard concrete. They were, after all, the service stairs, with the same sort of solid fire door one would expect in any modern building. We were just minding our own business and creeping down the stairs when one of these doors opened. I saw a figure in a dark blue suit framed in the doorway. Gulid yelled, "Gun!" And I raised my staff and impaloed the door shut in his face. There was a crack as the door trapped his arm, a loud bang as the gun went off, and a clang as the pistol hit the concrete floor. I didn't hear Gulid yell over the man's scream. He'd sustained fractures in both bones of his forearm. I let the door loose long enough for him to clear the gap and then slammed it shut again.
"Peter," said Gulid in a strange voice, "I think I've been shot."
I barely had the presence of mind to keep my impello up against the door as I turned to stare at Gulid, who was plucking at the bottom of her met vest. "Where?"
"There,"
said Gulid, pointing at a spot just above her hip.
"Have a look, will you?"
This is a thing that both Caffrey and Nightingale have impressed upon me. Most people only fall down when they're shot because the media tells them they're supposed to. Especially with something low caliber like a pistol round. The truth is that unless there's immediate death or gross mechanical damage, people can function quite normally, right up to the point where blood loss or shock kicks in. It's known in the police as walk, talk and die. Although mostly we run into it when motorcyclists get knocked off their bikes. That's why you've got to check your casualties, even when they're standing there with a puzzled look on their face. There was a definite hole in the heavy material of Gulid's public order boiler suit that widened when I stuck a finger in it to reveal a matching slice in the white t-shirt underneath.
Ow, said Galeed. Careful.
It would have taken way too long to dig out my pocket knife.